Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan back here once again at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality and not illusion or delusion that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, but please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line Dr. David Black, and we've had him on our other programs. He is a scholar, and he teaches, and of course he's going to be talking about what the real battle is. I've seen his articles up on the internet, and I was so intrigued by what he had to say that I really wanted him to come forward and be on my program and have our audience here in the evening listen to him. Dr. Black, thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you, Stan. It's good to be back.
Why don't you tell our listeners just a little bit about you personally, so they'll know who you are, where you're coming from.
Well, I currently live in Southern Virginia, and I teach at a school in North Carolina. I'm mostly ancient Greek, and I do edit a website called DaveBlackOnline.com, and have done a little bit of writing. My latest book is entitled Why I Stopped Listening to Rush. And it's subtitled Confessions of a Recovering Neocon. So it just is a very personal account of my own pilgrimage the last 3 or 4 years.
Why don't you tell us just a little bit about that pilgrimage? I mean, how you got to where you are today from where you were before?
Well, I think the change happened after September 11th for me, certainly. I can recall Candidate Bush talking about a humble foreign policy. I can remember Candidate Bush speaking about reducing U.S. forces. And I think most of us who voted Republican in 2000 like I did anticipated that the new administration would be very conservative. It would embrace conservative objectives, tax cuts, smaller government, a balanced budget, fiscal responsibility, and so on and so forth. Well, of course, none of this has happened. In fact, quite the opposite has happened, and so my website and my writings really are trying to call the attention of the public to the fact that I believe that our fundamental foundational beliefs are being subverted as never before in the name of an all-powerful state, and as a result, our God-given freedoms are being stripped away one freedom at a time. And so really it's a critique of our political, media, and educational establishments, which are today controlled by people who pay as much attention to the Constitution as you and I do to our junk email.
Well, I think that's really in part because the average individual really doesn't understand the Constitution, nor do they understand that liberty and limited federal government are synonymous, and that tyranny and total federal government are synonymous, and that you can't have liberty within a government that can regulate every aspect of our lives in the name of fighting terrorism, when of course they really are not fighting terrorism at all. They're not sealing our borders, they're not protecting our airplanes, they're doing everything they can to avoid really facing a terrorist threat, if there really is a terrorist threat in America. And the fact that there really is a terrorist threat, how can it be that we have all the bombings? We saw this one in Lebanon. We see the suicide bombers in Iraq. We see suicide bombers in Israel. But we just can't seem to get one suicide bomber here in the United States. So is the war on terrorism what we've been told, or are there other aspects of this whole incredible scenario that are not coming forward, but in the name of fighting terrorism, point after point after point, why the government is expanding its control over every aspect of our lives? And I share your concern, Dr. Black. If the American people don't wake up, pretty soon there'll be no freedom left. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and so you were talking about how we seem to be moving towards the total government state. In other words, regulation of just about everything, which is certainly not what the traditional Republican belief was. I've been a Republican for as long as I can remember. And, of course, Republicans stand for cutting back on government, and yet we seem to be expanding government. The Republicans stand for a balanced budget, and yet we have the biggest deficits, both trade deficits and domestic deficits of all time. So why are we having all of these problems? Why aren't we doing what we were promised?
We have simply, I think, departed very clearly from our nation's foundations. And there is a twofold foundation, as you know, Stan. There's a biblical and then there's a constitutional foundation. So as you can see, my website is committed to helping restore our nation to both its biblical and its constitutional foundations. And as I mentioned, September 11th, I think, was critical because after that point, a brand new vision of America arose. America would now use all of its military might to completely reshape world politics. It would do so by crushing tyrannical regimes and establishing quote-unquote democracies in their place. And then on the domestic front, as you know, now we're talking about not reducing the size of the federal government, but it's increasing by leaps and bounds. And the only question now was whether government growth will be merely big or gigantic. So what is happening is that while we are facing a coup d'etat of sorts in terms of our Constitution, few Americans seem concerned about it. They seem almost oblivious to what's going on. Their attitude is, we can trust our government, can't we? And I think there are times in life when anybody with a shred of principle needs to say, wait a minute, it's a lie and a deception to pretend that a man's religious convictions can justify an unconstitutional vision of government. And so I have come to the point in my own life that I've seceded from quote-unquote compassionate conservatism. I've had all about I can take of exaggerated intelligent reports, justifying attacks on sovereign nations, of the distortion of facts, the reliance on rumor to influence public opinion, hiding behind a curtain of PR or spin while sending hundreds of brave Americans to their deaths in Afghanistan and Iraq. And so I it's just troubling to me, and I'm just tired of the doublespeak. I'm tired of the duplicity. I'm tired of the contradictions in our foreign policy. I'm tired of Washington's control over the media. I'm tired of judicial activism run amok, and so I'm just simply asking the question, where are the Christian men and women today who will stand up and fight in the political arena without any compromise? And in my opinion, standards are scarcely to be found.
Well, I think that a large part of this is really because of the Christian leadership and their failure of the responsibility. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Black was just talking about really so many of the things that are going on today, which are totally contrary to what we should be doing. And he approaches the problem, first of all, from a biblical point of view, and then from a constitutional point of view. And I really think this is one of the big problems we have, is that you can't separate America's concepts of freedom from the Bible, from God. And of course, anybody who talks about the relationship between God and government is immediately accused of wanting a theocracy, but nothing could be further from the truth. The primary relationship between our government and God is the fact that we were the first country in all recorded history that acknowledged that freedom comes not from government, not from the king, not from our elected representatives, but from God, and that to ensure these God-given rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their power from the consent of the governed. That's what it says in the Declaration of Independence. That's what our Constitution was created to establish. And, of course, you can only have freedom in a free society if you have moral people. You'd either have moral people and limited government, we'll have immoral people, as we increasingly are becoming today. And then, of course, the only way that you can have any sense of semblance of law and order with a totally corrupt and immoral society where everybody is being, you know, totally selfish and unconcerned and has lost the moral vision and God's restraints is to have a tyrannical government. Because, well, I think it was William Penn who said so well, those who will not be ruled by God will be ruled by tyrants.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. Nice. I wrote that book, Why I Stopped Listening to Rush. It says very little, actually, about Rush Limbaugh. But what it really is addressing is his brand of conservatism, which basically says the Republican Party right or wrong. And that mentality currently pervades most conservative talk radio, as you know, Stan, except for your program and a few others. George Bush came into office advocating leaner government, and then he enlarged it by creating a gigantic new cabinet department. He's increased federal spending on a per capita basis more than any other modern president. He says now that he has had his accountability moment, and therefore he's scot-free to lead us into another war, probably in Iran, possibly in North Korea. George Washington put it this way: the essence of government is power, and power lodged as it must be in human hands will ever be liable to abuse. And so I'm simply asking this question. Does any Democrat, or does any Republican for that matter, make the slightest attempt to fulfill his oath to, quote, support and defend the Constitution of the United States, or, quote, bear true faith and allegiance to the same? And again, I think we'd have to admit that neither the Democratic Party nor the Republican Party is willing to throw off the shackles of the socialist welfare state. And if that's the case, then I believe a third party must do the job.
Well, you know, what's really so interesting is this dialectic process they have. It's the Democrats against the Republicans. It's the right against the left. It's the conservative against the liberal. And, you know, and the trouble is that doesn't give any place for those of us who might consider ourselves true liberals. In other words, we believe in limiting the power of government, and we believe in individual freedom. But I can't find that in the Republican Party. I certainly can't find that in the Democrat Party. It almost seems like we have no place to go. The tragedy of the Rush Limbaugh syndrome, as it would be, is the fact that he gives you the idea that, as you say, the Republicans are right and wrong, the Republicans are always right, the Democrats are always wrong. Then you go to Amy Goodman, who's on the left, and is on public radio across NPR, very articulate, very interesting programs, and of course, the Republicans are always wrong, and the Democrats are always right. So, you know, I think that we have to point out that we can't really trust the leaders of either political party, because neither group are led by truly moral men. Oh, they may profound morality, they may talk about God bless you and God bless America, but don't judge people by what they say. Look and see what they do. And right. When I see that the president has led us into a war by using totally false information, now whether he knew it was false or not, he should have known it was false, and he should have fired the people who gave him the false information. Who's been fired?
Mm-hmm. Not a one.
No one.
And we delight in criticizing Bill and Hillary, don't we? And yet we are completely blind to the equally serious transgressions of George W. Bush. And I think that Americans should be outraged. Should be outraged by our welfare state, our tax burden, our fiat money, our immigration system, our undersupported, our overextended military, our two-party stranglehold. And especially we should be enraged about our so-called compassionate leaders and their socialist political agenda that has reduced the Constitution to a worthless scrap of paper. So my point is that republicanism in America is being destroyed not by liberals but by conservatives. And don't we really care? Doesn't anybody care that our government is raining tyranny down on its people? The promise of the American Revolution was to limit the ability of government to tyrannize the people. So where are the true conservatives who are upholding the rule of law and the Constitution over the rule of man and the mere opinions and whims of men?
You know, it was really so interesting during the last election when so many of our Christian leaders would talk about the abortion issue. Well, I think the abortion issue is a very important issue. I think that abortion is totally immoral, and I agonize for the children who've been killed, you know, and slaughtered. But and since the Democrats are pro-abortion and the Republicans are nominally pro-life, and yet, of course, you don't judge people by what they say. You judge them by what they do. And, of course, have we done anything to stop abortion with the Republicans in? And remember, the Republicans have controlled the executive branch of government, well, most of the time since 1980. We had the 8 years of Bill Clinton, but all the rest of the time, the Republicans were in charge. That was 12 or 16 years where they've been in charge twice as long as the Democrats. And if they'd really wanted to stop this, they could have. They could have done it simply by executive order. They could have done it by, you know, telling Congress to pass legislation and put riders on it so that the Supreme Court couldn't intervene. But they didn't do that any more than they did that when they passed the partial abortion bill, which partial birth abortion bill, which made everybody really feel good and warm and fuzzy. But all the Supreme Court has to do is say it's unconstitutional, and courts all across America have done that and said it's unconstitutional. It was such a simple thing for the president to have said, and I want you to put in there a tag on that according to Article 3, Section 3 of the Constitution, the Supreme Court cannot intervene in this legislation, and they just didn't do it. So, obviously, it's all for show. The good-hearted people, the people who are really concerned, the Christians who really feel very deeply about the abortion issue, feel all warm and fuzzy, but nothing has changed and no lives have been saved.
Watch out when people want to do good for someone else. Because if there's one thing history has taught us, it's that the state that is out to do good is probably the most dangerous state of all.
Well, I think it was Thomas Paine who said that all societies are good, but government, even at its best, is a necessary evil. And I believe that that is absolutely true. I think that, as George Washington said, government is not eloquence, government is not persuasion, government is force. Like fire, it is a dangerous servant, but a fearful master. And I think we have to realize that government has become our master. Now the conservative Republican administration is talking about mental health testing of every child in America. The Republican administration has come up with a new educational bill, No Child Left Behind. That means no child will not be indoctrinated. This was Ted Kennedy's bill that was put forward by the Republicans. Why would the Republican administration of George Bush push Ted Kennedy's legislation? Is Ted Kennedy stupid, or is it possibly that there isn't a dime's worth of difference?
Well, if we can democratize the entire universe, then why can't we do what's best for men and women in our own country? And I think that the greatest damage to liberty and the Constitution has always been done by men and women of goodwill. I don't question their motivation. By men and women of goodwill who are convinced they know what is best for others. They know what's best for the economy. They know what's best for foreign powers. And to me, that is nothing but arrogance. People who assume they know what is best for everybody else. And C.S. Lewis once said, of all tyrannies, a tyranny sincerely exercised for the good of its victim is the most oppressive. I think he's right.
Well, you know, our founding fathers recognized that you could never trust men with power. And that is why they built into the Constitution a system by which, by law, Congress could not do anything that was not specifically specified in the Constitution. Now, men have found all sorts of means of getting around the Constitution. They really want to take the chains off of the government officials, and they want to mold them and force them to put onto the people because, oh, they mean so good for us. I mean, after all, who would want any children left behind? Who would want mentally ill children? So we're going to test them, and then we're going to forcibly medicate them with medications that may very well have permanent effect on their minds. But after all, we're from the government, and we know what's best for you. And people have forgotten that according to our Constitution, and the Tenth Amendment specifically stated that all powers not specifically here granted to Congress or reserved to it by the states are to be reserved to the states and to the people. We were to limit the power of the federal government. When was the last time anybody ever talked about that in Washington, D.C.?
And I believe that there's any doubt at all that from a strictly biblical viewpoint, the Republican form of government, the constitutional form of government which we have and was originally established in our country, is a better and wiser and fitter form than any other the world has ever known. Because what it did was it intentionally limited the power of elected officials. And it correctly acknowledged the fallenness of human nature and the tendency, as Lord Acton put it, for power to corrupt and for absolute power to corrupt absolutely. And therefore, as a Christian, I believe evangelical Christianity is absolutely right, absolutely correct in repudiating state absolutism.
And, of course, it was Jay Leno who recently said, you know, they're working on a constitution over there in Iraq.
Let's give them ours. We're not using it anymore.
Let's send them ours. We don't use ours anymore. And that really is so true. I hate to use Jay Leno as a source of information, but I think you have to understand that our leaders have sworn to uphold a constitution and have lied, because they swear to defend our constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And they are indeed the enemies of our Constitution. They violated at every turn with indiscretion. And where is the outcry from the Christian leaders of our country? Why, it's deafening and it's silent. We'll be back in just a moment. We'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 if you agree or disagree. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here with David Black, and our guest for the evening for this first hour, and we're certainly talking about not only about what's going on politically, but about what's happening spiritually, because you can't separate the two. And, of course, one reason I was so pleased to read Dr. Black's material is that he recognized that this is a spiritual battle being fought on a political battlefield, but you can't separate the spiritual from the political. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely, and I believe it's the Church of Jesus Christ, the evangelical church of today, that deserves the sharpest criticism for its compromising attitude toward what I have called the new patriotism, the blind patriotism that exists in our nation today, and because of its enthusiasm for the nation's arrogant empire building. And under the guise of contending for liberty, the country is actually perpetuating the old compromise of nationalism and gospel. Paganism in the form of state worship has invaded the church, and yet our leaders are silent, and it's we who proclaim the good news owe it to our congregations and owe it to our people to oppose this falsification of the gospel with all of our being. That's exactly what the Barman Declaration attempted to do in Nazi Germany. That's why Dietrich Bonhoeffer paid with his life. He simply said this, that when government begins to look like a Caesar, trying to elicit unquestioning and docile loyalty from an unthinking populace, then government has become a god. And when government demands to be worshipped as God, it's time for us to say no to government, because we've already said yes to the one word of God whom we are obligated to trust and obey in life. And so, tragically, just as the confessing church in Germany acted too late, I am of the belief that the evangelical church may be acting too late also. I hope we do not repeat their tardiness, but I cannot help but feel that a rude awakening is in store for us today.
Well, you know, there's a wonderful book, and I think you were well acquainted with it. It's called Hitler's Cross. It's written by Dr. Erwin Lutzer, who's the senior pastor at the Moody's Bible Church, and it's a book we carry through my ministry because we think it's so important, because it talks about the Christian church in Germany and how there they were preaching Romans 13, obedience to the state. After all, God put the rulers in power. God put Hitler there, so we must be obedient to Adolf Hitler. And then, of course, the ministers, they were all afraid to speak out. They wanted to go along. They wanted to be accepted. They didn't want to rock the boat. And of course, many of them were paid by the state, just as here in America we have that 501c3 status. And if you're a minister and you say something against the government or from a political point of view on the pulpit, why, of course, they could revoke your 501c3 status, and horrors, people might not contribute to anymore. And that, even more frightening than the 501c3 status, is the faith-based initiative, where many of our major ministries across America have received massive amounts of money. And now we're talking about $2 million for Chuck Colson's ministry. And Chuck Colson has a wonderful ministry, and they do a great deal of good. But is Chuck Colson going to be critical of the government that's given him $2 million? And Pat Robertson's got $1.5 million. And Pat's ministry has done a great deal of good. But is Pat Robertson going to be critical of a government that has given him these large sums of money? And as I contemplate what Erwin Lutzer wrote about is what happened in Hitler's Germany, and I see what's going on today, I have a feeling of deja vu all over again.
Right, and there's a lot of talk in our political establishment today, as you know, about religion, but not true faith. And if you look at the fruit,
Hold that thought for just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening, Dr. David Black, and we're talking about, of course, the lack of response of the church to what's going on in America today. And I was simply mentioning that not only do we have a 501c3 status for many of our churches, which more or less intimidates many ministers to get them fearful to come forward, but now we have the faith-based initiative by which you can buy the support of ministries. And not that many of these ministries, and I mentioned Chuck Colson's ministry got $2 million, and Chuck Colson has a wonderful ministry, and he does wonderful things, and he's helping many people, but is he going to speak out critically against a government that's given him $2 million? And the same would be true of Pat Robertson, who has a tremendous impact and has a tremendous ministry. but he got $1.5 million. Have they bought his silence? Is he really, do you honestly believe, he's going to speak out critically of the Bush administration that was so generous towards him so he could do so much good?
Well, I don't take a penny from the federal government, and I know you don't either.
They take a lot of pennies from me, that's for sure.
More and more of our money, as you just said, is being forced from us via taxes and handed over to faith-based charities. Now, please tell me in the Bible where it says that followers of Christ are to trust government to care for our needs. We should turn to one another, and we should be able to give willingly as we are able and as we feel called to do so. God loves a cheerful giver. But it's kind of hard to be cheerful when the state is coercing you to, quote-unquote, give money they claim will be used to help your fellow man.
Amen.
And we all know how efficiently the feds are handling our money today. So, again, I really think we need to get to the heart of the issue. Yes, books are important. I think Why Stop Listening to Rush is a good book. I think Erwin Lutz's book is a good book. But, you know, the most important thing I think we can put in the hands of people is the Bible and the Constitution. And I would add the Declaration of Independence, because, you see, we have raised an entire generation of Americans that don't have a clear picture of a Republican history. Our schools don't teach the Declaration. Our schools don't teach the principles of the Constitution. Few Americans understand the foundation for our freedoms, and even less do they understand where our freedoms are threatened today.
Amen.
So the traditional emphasis on freedom from government has been replaced by, as you know, the warfare welfare state. So, what's happened to the American ideal that was once rooted in the concept of personal freedom? Basically gone. The philosophy of the less government we have, the better, no longer permeates the American mind and attitude. And I think that nowhere is this confusion more obvious today than in the evangelical church.
Well, let's go to Matt, who's calling us from Austin, Texas. Hi, Matt.
Hey, doing today, Doctor.
I'm doing fine. How are things down there in Austin?
Well, we're staying warm these days.
Okay, fine. Did you have a question or a comment for our guest?
You know, I understand what you're all talking about, but what about the UPC symbols? Have y'all understood what's going on with those things or no?
No, I'm not quite certain what you're talking about. Could you explain what those symbols are?
Well, we don't understand the UPC symbol that's on every single thing that we buy.
Oh, you're talking about the identification symbols on various things we buy? Are you talking about the barcodes? Are you talking about the radio frequency coding that they're putting on? What, specifically?
Yeah, the United Product Code, exactly. The code that's going on every single thing that we own. If you look at every single code we own, I wonder why there's a 6 on the right and left, also in the middle. Now, there are particular codes on cigarettes, maybe beer, maybe books that are more primitive than others, but like the main ones on ladders or on doors or on garbage cans, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I don't want to go on and on. But there seems to be a double single line, not only on the left and on the right, but also in the middle that seems to hang down. If anybody grabs anything around them, they can grab it and look at it.
I know. Well, certainly that what you're saying is correct. Do you have any thoughts at all on that, Dr. Black?
No, I really don't have anything to say on the UPC symbol.
Well, but I would suggest, Matt, that what you're saying is absolutely correct. If you, of course, read the book we have, it's called A Masonic and Occult Symbols. It's written by Dr. Kathy Burns. You'll find that the 666 seems to be a very prevalent number today, and you have to ask yourself, why are they so intent upon using 666 in so many things? And I think you know the answer as well as I do. Hey, thanks so much for calling.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye. Well, I think, in fact, I would simply point the World Futures Society, the Futurist magazine put out by the World Futures Society, and you find some of the world's leading occultists there, number two man in the United Nations, Marie Strong. You find Robert McNamara, that great patriot who sent our boys to fight and bleed and suffer and die over in Vietnam, but never to win. A man who, incidentally, at least according to West Magazine, a frequent visitor to the occult center that Marie Strong has set up. Barbara Marx Hubbard, who talks about the necessity of killing a third of the world's population. Their logo was 3 sixes in a circle, but, well, they changed it. We started talking about it. Now, well, if it's still there, we have copies if anybody'd like to see it. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and we were just talking about symbols, and we'll get off. I just wanted to mention that, for instance, the emblem, the logo of the Trilateral Commission that was created by David Rockefeller and Zygmunt Brzezinski is three intertwining sixes. You'll find these same emblems used over and over again. You'll even find them on Christian objects, and they will tell you those three intertwining sixes are a symbol of the Trinity. And, of course, you'll find that on the front page of the book, The Aquarian Conspiracy, going into the whole New Age movement and how it works, written by a New Age mover. They understand the significance of all of these things. Unfortunately, most church leaders, most Christians, have no idea that we are truly involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. And until we understand this is a spiritual battle, the Christians have to decide which side they're going to be on, because there is no middle ground. You're going to have to be either on God's side or on the side of the prince of this earth. And I really believe that we tried and found wanting, because most Christians just want to go along with the easiest thing. We want to feel good about ourselves. We really don't want to face the fact that, as the Bible teaches us, we're all sinners saved by grace. Our founding fathers realized we were sinners, that you could never trust men with power. That's why they created a constitutional republic and limited the power of government. And that whole concept certainly has been forgotten, hasn't it?
Well, what do our politicians believe today? They believe that society can be altered, radically altered, by means of state finance. State coerced public education, state financed health education, welfare programs, speech codes, and so on. Christianity teaches regeneration. Men are not changed by politics. Men are changed by God. And so you have to understand that the role of government is never to make men virtuous, and civil governments that attempt to create a virtuous society are called totalitarian governments. And if you look at the Republicans today, their speeches and statements and policy statements, if they do nothing else, prove to every thinking American that the president adheres to the notion of a deified state that can solve all of our nation's problems, in fact, can solve the world's problems. And this policy, in my opinion, is not only unconstitutional, it's clearly unbiblical. And this would include, as you mentioned, the so-called faith-based initiative, which that sounds very exciting, but in reality, it will only make churches dependent on public money, in direct contradiction to the Bible. Paul teaches in 1 Corinthians 9:7, giving is to be completely voluntary. And so we have a politician in office today who tends to be a social engineer, offering us programs to solve this or that social ill, while the Scripture, and we must be clear, promises a changed life only as a result of a personal relationship with God.
And how far we've gotten away from that, too. The leaders of both political parties will be back in just one moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Dr. David Black. And certainly we're going to open up for calls now. Our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 464-8295. But before I do, Dr. Black, would you like to tell people about your website, how they can get your book, how they can, of course, get more information on your writings and your views?
Our website is entitled DaveBlackOnline.com. If you go to the home page on the left-hand side, you can click on the cover of my book. It's entitled Why I Stopped Listening to Rush. In addition to that, I have a book box. It contains about 16 or 17 of my other 22 published books that they can click on. It'll take them directly to Amazon.com, which is currently offering sales on several of them. So probably the easiest thing for them to do would be to go to DaveBlackOnline.com.
All right, fine. Well, let's go to Dan, who's calling us from Spokane, Washington. How are you this evening, Dan?
Well, pretty good. Pretty good. I'm enjoying this show. And, you know, I tell you, I have a question, and I would like to ask it. How do you interest the average person in government? I mean, how do you do it? I'm involved in the Republican Party a little bit, just a little bit, and even within the party, there's a tremendous amount of disinterest. And then if you go outside of the party, there is absolutely no interest. And the only thing that seems to get people interested at all is their personal finances. If you approach them saying, well, this will affect your standard of living, and this is how it will do it, then suddenly you can get some interest. And I mean that. I'm not being facetious. if you approach them on a very personal basis and how it will affect their bank account, you can generate some interest. But you can't come to them with large ideas. You mentioned C.S. Lewis. He's my hero, you know, and should be all of our hero. But I think he's a great thinker. And one of the books he wrote was Abolition of Man. In that book, he talks about how the educational system can educate people out of their own interest, out of their humanity. You know, and I think that that's happened with our educational system. You run across people today who just have got no idea about the larger issues, about what's, you know, what really is being said when a politician gets up and talks about Social Security. They don't make any tie-in between socialism and separate that out from capitalism. It's just beyond them. I'm talking about accountants, college professors, plumbers, and steam fitters. I mean, it just crosses a whole section of society. No one is interested in this subject anymore.
Well, that's, Dr. Black, how would you respond to Dan? How can we get people to be concerned about it? I mean, he's frustrated, quite obviously. So how would you suggest he approach the situation?
On January 27th, I published on my website an article entitled, Is the Cost of Empire Worth It? And I quote Bonhoeffer once again, who said the ultimate test of a moral society is the kind of world it leaves to its children. What we have today is a Congress that is spending more and more while sending bigger and bigger bills to our children. And the cost of empire is just simply staggering. And as far as I'm concerned, both parties have declared war on our children's future. Today's conservatives want it all. They want hegemony, they want guns, they want butter, and they want tax cuts. Everybody knows this is a pipe dream. And America's foreign policy is going to bankrupt future generations of Americans. But we will have no one to blame but ourselves. As I point out in my book, Why I Stopped Listening to Rush, Thomas Jefferson and Patrick Henry protested against a tyrant who was taxing the colonials at a rate of about 5%. Today, the average American is taxed at the rate of about 50%. If that shit doesn't get your attention, I don't know what will.
Well, you know, it doesn't get their attention.
All right, Dan, let me give you my response. Because, first of all, you talked about the professors. You talked about a lot of people, most of them, you mentioned, had college educations. And they are the most dangerous because so many of them are educated, and all they know is what they've read. They talk to one another. And, of course, they have never really been allowed to understand the very essence of our country. First of all, I believe that you get people's attention by convincing them there's a problem. The old adage is you can't convince people they're going to die or they should buy life insurance until you can convince them they're going to die. And if you've ever had a life insurance salesman come and give you the pitch, the first thing he's going to do is ask you what's going to happen to your family if and when you die. That gets your concern. So what I try to do is try to find something that will affect an individual. And one of them, I believe, is their children. And, of course, as Dr. Black was talking about, the tremendous debt we're leaving to our children. I'd like to talk about the fact that how would you feel if they have to institute the draft and they take your son over and he's killed in the Middle East? How would you feel about that? Well, that's something that's really going to get to them. How would you feel if you realized that they were poisoning your child's mind? Do you know anything? Have you ever read the scientific studies that have been done on the impact of fluoride on the IQ, or the impact of mercury on the IQ, or the impact of aspartame and NutraSweet on the IQ of your children? Try to get something, or your grandchildren, try to get something that, of course, you can talk to them about and have the documentation that you can give them. One thing I think that may very well, hopefully, have an impact is my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, which gets into the spiritual nature of the battle. And if you read that book and you don't know there's a problem, why, forget about them. They're beyond hope. But, you know, we really believe you have to have something that will touch them. I think the finances are concerned. What would you do if the dollar collapsed and you lost your annuities, your bank accounts, your CDs, everything you've worked so hard for, and you go get your pension, but, you know, $1 million would buy a loaf of bread? It's happened in other countries. Could it happen here? What about the irresponsible leaders who have massive deficits? Has it happened in other countries? Why couldn't it happen here? Things of this sort, Dan. You just keep listening to our program. We'll try to give you the ammunition to use. But ask questions. Spend more time asking questions than telling people there's a problem. And then remember, you can't sell life insurance until you can convince people they're going to die.
Well, you know, I think you're right, and I listen to your program a lot, and I get a lot of ideas from it, and I have read your book, Dr. Stan, and I think you're right on the money. But there again, those are large ideas, and should you be asking the average citizen to understand those ideas, you know, that's what I run across. You know, where are our intellectuals here? They're supposed to kind of guard the gate. And they have really dropped the ball here. You know, we're at
the professor who asked his student, "What's the greatest problem in the world today? Ignorance or indifference?" The student said, "I don't know, and I don't care."
just right. That's exactly right. Well,
adage that says when you do nothing, something always happens.
Well, yeah, there you go.
That's what's happening in our culture.
Well,
we have abdicated the responsibility of running our lives and given it to someone else to do it for us. Instead of doing it for ourselves, we have invited the foxes into the coop. And guess what the foxes have done?
I know.
Well, they've done what foxes have always done. They've eaten our chickens. So that's going to continue, I believe, until things only get worse and worse and worse, until enough of us are willing to raise a large enough hue and cry to make our politicians realize they can't get away with it forever. But things, I believe, are going to have to get a lot worse. Don't you agree, Dan?
I agree with you. I agree with you totally. And of course, Dan, you agree with that as well, don't you?
I do agree with that. And I will say this though, I am disappointed in the natural order of things. Generally speaking, our professors are supposed to watch the gate, you know. And this is they should understand or make it their business to understand what's actually taking place intellectually. And they have, you know, Dr. Stan, Dr. Black, they have not. I wonder about that. You know, what has happened there? But any case, I'll hang up. You helped me with your ideas, and thank you for this
being
program.
Being a professor myself, I would just simply say this. Don't trust the person sitting on the opposite side of that mahogany desk. Listen to your common sense. Listen to your intuition. And that's what has made my website so popular. I'm not saying anything new. I'm simply verbalizing what thousands and thousands of people know already to be true. I'm just putting into the words for them. The Constitution is as timeless as the hills. It's as relevant as our daily newspaper. But we will never, ever see it in use again until we breathe life back into it and give it a fair chance. That's what we need to do in our country.
That is exactly right. And well, God bless both you gentlemen. I appreciate your program. I really do.
That's fine. Thank you. Give my best to Gloria. And, of course, I would just simply point out that we have an awful lot of people who listen to our program. We're truck drivers who work in factories, who are farmers. They got a lot of common sense. I think that tragically, in the academic atmosphere, many people have been schooled in one philosophy, and they've never been allowed to hear the other. I know this is what happened to me when I went to University of California in Berkeley. I had no idea of any of the things we're talking about now. All I knew is what I was taught by my teachers, and I wasn't educated. I was indoctrinated. It was years before I could begin to think independently. We've got to try to get people to think independently, and I take two approaches. One is to try to convince them that the media is controlled, number one. And the second one is that we are a republic and not a democracy, and somebody has been playing games with a reality. If you can convince them simply of those two things, why, you're well on your way to, hopefully, to begin to getting them to understand what's going on. Well, let's go to Ray, who's calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, how you doing, Ray?
Oh, pretty good, Dr. Stan. I just want to say, I'm on Social Security, and I'm very concerned about that. But my real question was, I've been hearing rumors that George W. Bush was a 33rd degree Mason.
I don't believe it.
But I don't know.
I really don't. He's skull and bones, but
there's
no proof.
If he was 33rd degree, he'd be satanic already. Mm. Above 33, they're satanic. As far as I know, they worship Satan. You know?
Well, there's a lot of... I know I've talked to 32nd degree Masons,
yeah,
who really don't understand what this is all about. There certainly is, at some levels of Masonry, and some people in the 33rd really do understand it, and I'm sure that there's some who really don't understand
mm-hmm.
it. But, you know, the average Mason has no idea of the background of the history of Masonry.
Mm-hmm.
He's a guy who just likes to have a good time,
mm-hmm.
and he likes to wear a little red hat,
yeah,
and they go out and they drink, and they're with the boys, and they do a lot of good. And they have the Shrine hospitals, and they give
right,
a charity, and they look after one
right,
another.
Yeah.
they do not understand, of course, the real purpose of Masonry, at least as laid out by the Masonic leaders of old. So anything else you'd like to say, Ray?
Yeah. How would I get a hold of Professor Quigley's book?
Well, you can get it to our ministry at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Okay. Now, they may have it down at the public library, and maybe you can take it out from there. But if you want to buy a copy, we do carry them to our ministry.
Was that book, did they destroy the plates or something?
They destroyed the plates to the first half of the book, and then they wouldn't republish it. And what happened was somebody had a copy, and they started pirating it. Oh. And so they kept it in print that way, for many years. And finally, the publisher refused to republish it, so Quigley got the rights back, and then the pirate went to Quigley and said, I'll give you $3 a book if I have your permission to publish the book. And Quigley wanted that money very much, Professor Quigley did, and so that's how the book came to remain in print. However, the publisher did everything they could to keep it out of print, because it tells too much.
Like
the professor. In fact, there was an article in the Washington Post about the professor who knew too much, and that was Professor Quigley.
Right, yeah.
Okay, anything else, Ray?
Okay, that's it.
Okay, God bless you. Let's go to Roger, who's calling from Pennsylvania. Hi, Roger. Do you have a question?
First, I hope you're not surprised to hear that I found Dr. Black, to be one of the most delightful and encouraging guests you've had in quite some time. From a few weeks back, I had a few leftover comments to bounce off you two folks, and it was just and do have him back very soon, I hope. A guy who we all do prefer our categories nice and neat and tidy and universal. So it's really tragic to find oneself agreeing so much of the time with Barbara Boxer, and even more distressing now, upwards of two-thirds of the time with Eleanor Clift on McLaughlin.
Pelosi, Nancy Pelosi here in California. Isn't that terrible when I find my agreeing with her? But anyway, did you have a question for our guest? Because we got another people on the line waiting.
You recall from a while back that a minor note, Michael Savage, actually Wiener, has been on the warpath against both Rust Limpjaw and Matt Drudge, except that it's no more substance than jealousy.
Do you have a question, though?
Yeah, about Wiener. It's like the establishment pot calling the apparatchik kettle black. What do you think of that?
Do you have any comment on that?
Well, I think the truth is that neither the Democrats nor the Republicans have let alone a constitutional or a biblical model for any type of reform in our country, including welfare reform.
And I think, Ray, it's sort of like the fights between Abbott and Costello and Laurel and Hardy. They're very entertaining, but of course, in the final analysis, they really don't matter. Thanks so much, and let's go to John calling from Post Falls, Idaho. Is this John?
Yes.
Okay, do you have a question?
Well, a brief comment you gentlemen perhaps could react to. As you know, George Bush has been beating the drum for renewal of the Patriot Act in all its incarnations, and then John Negroponte has been appointed as the new czar of all intelligences. And there's a quote of C.S. Lewis's that just jumped out at me on the Internet, and it is, of all tyranny, a tyranny sincerely exercised for the good of its victims may be the most depressive. It may be better to live under robber barons than under omnipotent moral busybodies.
All right. How would you respond to that, Dr. Black?
I agree, absolutely. George Bush ran as the un-Clinton. He's, in fact, the anti-Jefferson. He's intent on canceling the Bill of Rights, and the USA Patriot Act is anything but patriotic.
Amen.
That is, if you interpret it in light of the old Constitution and not the new living Constitution.
I agree with you totally. Oh, anything else, John?
Well, just briefly, I totally respect my Congressman Butch Otter going against the Republican mainstream and opposing that act, and I support him entirely in that. Thank you.
Thank you. And let's go to Doug, who's calling us from Montana. Hi, Doug. How are you doing?
Fine. How are you doing?
Doing just fine.
I have a question. I missed most of your program tonight. So I didn't hear the your guest very much of it, what he had to say, So I have a question I've been going to ask somebody, and this is it. The chemtrails that everybody's talking about.
Right.
Okay, the bad guys caused them to fall on all of us, but why wouldn't it have an adverse effect on the bad guys, too? There would have to be some sort of an antidote or something, and somebody should be able to collect that, and they'll see what the I never hear what that actually is.
Well,
coming down.
Basically, we've got some new 4-tape set on the chemtrails, and you have to understand what this is really all about. We don't have all the answers, but we got a lot of them, and some of the material that Mr. Cornicum has come up with, and some of the material that we have from other sources, will really give you tremendous insight into what's really going on. So, the chemtrails, well, apparently it's primarily barium and aluminum and things of that sort, and it's being used to alter weather. It's being used to create a shield, almost like an umbrella, for global warming. Many, many explanations for it. I'm not sure that it's harmful, but there's a potential for it. Right now, if it is harmful, it's going to get them as well as us. But I don't think it's specifically is going to give us all the flu or all AIDS or something like that, at least not right now. Thanks so much, Doug.
Yeah.
But if you'd like to get that new 4-tape set on chemtrails, it's got a lot of information.
Well, I just need your...
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Dr. David Black. And do you have any part of, we've got 3 minutes before I have to let you go. Why don't you sort of wrap up your thoughts for this evening?
I would just say this. I believe the main problem in America today is that the state has taken over the role of God. It is a theological problem. It is a spiritual problem. Government today employs us, government feeds us, government regulates us, and government now claims to be able to solve all of our problems, including gambling. Just ask Bill Bennett. And for most Americans, Stan, the state has become their church, and the federal government has become an idol. And it has stripped us, individuals and communities, of our social responsibilities, and it has begun and it has continued to engage in the immoral transfer of wealth. And as you know, since the New Deal, a trickle has become a flood. The Bible teaches that the church is to fulfill Paul's injunction to do good to all men. The Bible is to help non-Christians in need. The Bible says Christians are to feed the hungry, clothe the naked, house the homeless, heal the sick. No believer is exempt from this responsibility. And I realize that today it's impolitic to criticize the sacred cow, the great society, and the welfare state, and merely to question the legitimacy of welfare is to commit blasphemy against the state. But I believe it is time for Christians to reject the gods of statism and socialism, including the misnamed welfare system. So let's just get back to the Bible. Let's just get back to the Constitution. It's as simple as that.
And we were to take care of the widows and the orphans, and certainly the tragedy is that this promise of the state to look after us is a lie. You go into Russia today, there are riots because they're cutting back on social welfare. You go into Germany and into France, there are riots because they're cutting back on the social welfare, the pensions they promised to give the people. And ladies and gentlemen, what they're not telling you now is that this whole social welfare system that they have set out is going to collapse. 10 years from now, half of all the federal income is going to go for entitlements for the elderly, and that's what this is all about, what George Bush is all about. They know, they do not want you to know that the system is on the verge of collapse. 10 years from now, half of all the federal income, and there won't be anything left for roads or, you know, for defense or anything. Half of it's going to go to take care of the elderly, and, well, the only one solution, that is to do away with a lot of the elderly. And could that possibly be in the back of some people's minds when they keep telling you to rush down and get your flu shot? Because there's only 2 more weeks before the flu season is over, and they know the toxic doses of mercury there. Well, that's another subject. Dr. Black, thank you so much for being with us this evening. It's always a pleasure having you.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Good night, and God bless you.
God bless you.
Okay, fine. Well, I hope you enjoyed our program. Yeah. Really, it's very different, but Dr. Black... Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and I hope you enjoyed our program this evening with Dr. David Black. Remember, his website is daveblack.com. That's daveblack.com. And a lot of good common sense. I've really grown to respect. We've had a chance. This is the third program we've done with him, but I've enjoyed everyone, and, well, I hope you enjoyed the programs as well this evening. But this is the time when I need to remind our listeners out across America that we are primarily listener-supported. And if you believe that there's a problem and you believe we have an opportunity to reach out as we do 5 hours a day somewhere in America on radio, 5 hours a day on the Internet, 3 hours a day you can hear on RadioLiberty.com, and then the other websites. We've got on about five internet sites carry some of our programming. 5 hours a day on satellite, 4 hours a day on the shortwave, and people all across America, all across the world are listening to this program tonight. What a privilege it is for me to do it, but if you'd like to help us, we'd love to have you join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, and that's how we're able to do what we do. Now, I do want to mention that we have republished Brotherhood of Darkness. We're getting down. The original publisher went out of business, so they gave me permission to reprint my own book. And the more you print, the less the cost for each individual one. So we have an amazing offer that we've made for cases of books, 62 books to the case. If you'd like to know more about that, about getting a case of books, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. I think you'd be surprised, and I hope pleased. And if you think the book is important, if you think it has a message that if we can get people to read it will perhaps impact on their thinking, impact on their lives, give them a call at 1-800-544-8927. Now, if you'd like to get a free copy of one of our newsletters, our November newsletter tells about fluoride and how it's poisoning our children. The December newsletter is the testimony of Dr. William Hersey, who is the vice president of the scientists who work for the union of the scientists who work for the Environmental Protection Agency. And Dr. William Hersey's position is in the Department of Safe Drinking Water, and he analyzes drinking water. And of course, he and the other scientists who work for the EPA are trying to get the people to realize they're poisoning our people, they're poisoning our children. And that was the thrust of his testimony back in the year 2000. But since the other side controls the media, and if you don't believe that, you need to get the book we carry called The New Media Monopoly by Professor Ben Bagdakian. This is the 7th edition of the book. The New Media Monopoly, you'll hear it discussed on the programs put out, the radical left, the radical right never mentions that, the conservatives never mention that, because they don't want you to understand that so many of the publications that most people think are conservative are controlled by the same people who control the liberal publications. So that's the new media monopoly, but of course we do hope that you'll want to get the information we talk about, but certainly if you'd like a copy of either November or December newsletters, and the December newsletter again is Dr. William Hersey's testimony before the Senate, totally blocked out by the controlled media. Our January newsletter is a little different tact. It's a book review and an analysis of a book recently published that has been really, of course, boomed by the radical left. It's called Confessions of an Economic Hitman, but there's a great deal of truth in the book, and I think you'll be fascinated by the material. Certainly, Mr. Perkins is not coming from the same spiritual perspective I am, but I believe he's a very nice man, and I believe he's very sincere, and he's got a lot of very important information. So our January newsletter is going out probably, if you were subscribed to the newsletter, you'll have it by the middle of next week. But, of course, if you'd like a free copy, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Go to our website at RadioLiberty.com and then pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And we'll be back here in just a few minutes with another fascinating program you won't want to miss. Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us this evening Joel Skousen, who is the editor of World Affairs Brief, and certainly you want to go to his website. You want to pull down the information there every morning so that you can stay on top of the rapidly changing events that are taking place. And then, of course, we hope that many of you will want to get and actually subscribe to his newsletter. But right now, let's introduce Joel. Hi, Joel. Thank you so much for being with us again tonight.
My pleasure, Dr. Stan.
Well, let's just you pick up and tell us where we're going to go for this hour.
Well, I'll give everyone a preview of tomorrow's briefing for February 18th. First and most important topic is the U.S. building a pretense for war in the Middle East. It seems that the U.S. is ever eager to seize upon any justification to confront Syria and Iran. Two cases in point this week. One, a trumped-up speculation about an explosion near Iran's nuclear facility. And two, the deadly car bombing in Beirut, Lebanon, that targeted recently retired Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri, which killed and wounded many others. It was a very tragic thing. But now, even though the U.S. media made much of the Iranian explosion, I'll take that up first, it turned out to be a non-event. Not only was the explosion not near Iran's main nuclear reactor, it was about 100 miles distance. 100 miles is a fair distance. It was an explosion at a dam site that had nothing to do with nuclear power or weapons. But from all the hubbub, you would have thought that the U.S. or Israel had secretly attacked Iran's nuclear program. Speculation, by the way, to that effect was being aired on the Internet and elsewhere. It certainly did give the U.S. an excuse, of course, to vent its concern once again over Iran's nuclear program, which is still nascent, although there was nary a word about said from the U.S. about Russia's latest decision to provide more nuclear fuel to Iran. So there is this double standard, Dr. Stan, as usual. The real axis of evil, Russia and China, get a pass, while Iran and Syria, two important but small players in the Middle East, are coming under increasing focus.
And, of course, North Korea, apparently, and both China, both are providing the missile technology to both Iran and Syria and to all the countries over there. They provided it to Libya and to Saudi Arabia and to Pakistan. And, of course, if you can have all the weapons you want to, if you don't have any means to deliver them, why, if they don't do you much good? And yet, of course, we totally ignore the fact that the technology that allows them to have accurate missiles came from communist China. And, of course, where did communist China get that missile technology? Why, they got it from the United States. It was transferred to them in the Clinton administration, and we are supposed to believe, of course, that Bill Clinton allowed the transfer of some of our most sophisticated and dangerous missile technology to communist China for a donation of $100,000 or $200,000 in campaign funds, and I think that is simply a cover for something far more sinister. What are your thoughts?
Well, certainly, and Russia, of course, is also in the league. Now, they've just agreed to provide advanced missiles to Syria, so they're very much in this as well as China.
We'll be back in just a moment here with Joel Skousen right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Go ahead, Joel. Just pick up from there.
Well, the second issue of the Beirut car bombing unleashed a tornado of finger-pointing and accusations by the U.S. against Syria. Syria, who has been running a de facto occupation of Lebanon for the past 15 years. Now, the best analysis of the events comes from Brazilian journalist Pepe Escobar, now a senior correspondent for the Asia Times out of Hong Kong. It's amazing what Asia Times has surged to the forefront of good reporting, even though, you know, it comes from somewhat of a leftist slant. They really have cutting-edge people that they've employed who are excellent analysts like Pepe Escobar. He starts out, blame it on Syria. Blame it on Al-Qaeda. Better yet, blame it on both. Without a shred of evidence, or perhaps profiting from intelligence amassed by the Pentagon, quote, intelligence, the Israeli Mossad or the Bush administration immediately blamed Syria for the bombing that killed Mr. Beirut, former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri. And, of course, Washington recalled its ambassador to Damascus, Margaret Scobie. My comments are, who immediately called for Syria to withdraw its 15,000 occupation troops, according to Security Council Resolution 1559. Now, this is kind of strange because Syria already announced its intention 2 months ago to withdraw most of its troops, started the process, at least 3,000 or 4,000 went back across the border. But it has, true to form, been dragging its feet as to implementation. I think the U.S. knows Syria has no intention of letting Lebanon be free, so pushing the troop withdrawal issue is a known issue of provocation there with Syria. Syria and Iran have recently talked about making common cause with each other to thwart the U.S. attempts to isolate each one of them and treat them separately. So, the U.S. is calling this a conspiracy to, work against democracy in the nation, but it could be viewed as defensive as well. Now, there's a Saudi connection here, too, with Hariri, and this is one thing that I've been researching for tonight's brief. First of all, an unknown group for the advocacy of holy war in the Levant at first assumed responsibility on Al Jazeera television. Then another unknown group, the Al-Qaeda organization in the Levant, dismissed on an Islamist website any jihadi influence in the bombing. The trouble is with both of these pronouncements is that these are both unknown, leading many to believe that the anonymous calls of these people were fronting for black ops by foreign governments.
Hold that thought for just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Joel Skousen, who's the editor of World Affairs Brief, and we're talking about the bombing in Lebanon that, of course, killed the former premier of Lebanon, a very, very wealthy man who is an Arab, and of course, but he certainly is taking a strong stand against the Syrian occupation of Lebanon. The premier of Lebanon is a Christian, but of course he has simply been going along with the Syrians. So we have a very strange situation here. And of course, Joel was simply saying there's a lot of question. Who was responsible for this massive bombing? This was not an isolated act, an isolated terrorist act. This was a very sophisticated military, almost like a military operation. And there's some people who are saying this has every earmark of work of a major intelligence network here. In other words, some foreign intelligence network is involved. Certainly, there's an article that was up in WorldNet Daily out of Great Britain, in fact, written by a man from the Royal Institute of International Affairs, which is the British counterpart of the Council on Foreign Relations, and that article suggests that this was actually an American intelligence operation. Now, we just don't know, do we, Joel?
No, and certainly we're not going to know. The U.S. is promoting this international investigation. This is going to be a political exercise akin to the 9/11 Commission. But let me tell you a little bit of the background of Hariri that I found out.
This is the man who was killed.
That's correct.
Ex-premier.
He was a multimillionaire who had shady contacts with Saudi Arabian arms dealers in Syria itself and Britain. According to Barry Shaw, there's a connection between Hariri and the Syrian expat, London-based multimillionaire Wafik Saeed. Saeed had close ties to the British government, and he's a multimillionaire, lives in London there, both Saeed and Harari formed a corporation, Barakah. It's an arms importing, this is where Harari made a lot of his money, importing arms via Saudi Arabia to Syria. This doesn't sound to me very much like opposition to the Syrian regime in Lebanon, and it also seems to defuse the reason that the Syrians would have had a motive to kill Harari. He was, in fact, by even Israeli intelligence, highly regarded by Bashar Assad, al-Assad, the Syrian president. He met with him just last week. Apparently, they did have differences on the backing of General Emil Laoud, who's the present pro-Syrian strongman, just granted a three-year extension to his mandate as the current president in Lebanon. Now, some people are saying that that's the reason Harari was knocked off by Syria, because of his opposition to Laoud. But I doubt it. Puppets in Syria are a dime a dozen. They're not going to knock off their, one of their biggest arms suppliers, just because of his political opposition to General Laoud. So this is, of course, a very serious provocation as far as the United States is concerned, even with evidence lacking completely. They are, by innuendo, pinning this on Syria by the tone of the statements by not only the Secretary of State, the ambassador, and several other people speaking for the Bush administration. These are threatening tones, and that means that they have judged Syria responsible for this, and frankly, I am very much in doubt that Syria pulled this off. First of all, this has Syria has the, even by Israeli admission, the finest sniper corps in the entire Middle East. Did not have to use a massive car bomb. This is a car bomb of very sophisticated level of explosives that took out over 100 people. I mean, this is very, very unlike the typical car bomb of insurgents in Iraq. Or Palestinian terrorists. This has the earmark of very, very sophisticated bombers of the kind that obviously, black operations of major governments have access to. And there's obviously, when you ask the question who benefits, cui bono, the U.S. Looking for an excuse, as I've titled this week's brief, a pretense for war, certainly looks like it could be a chief candidate for pulling off something like.
And I think it's really very difficult for the average American to believe that our government leaders would even consider such a terrible, dishonest, disreputable thing, and yet why they falsified the records of the weapons of mass destruction that got us into Iraq, and all the people have died there, both on our side and the Iraqis. But if anybody has not yet read something called Operation Northwood, that's Operation Northwood. It's up on the Internet. It's verified to be accurate by James Bovard in his Body of Evidence book. We actually have it included in our syllabus. It's called Iraq, the Untold Story. It was basically the plan of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to precipitate a war with Fidel Castro in 1962. And the things that they suggested doing, like blowing up one of our satellites going into space with John Glenn in it and then blaming it on Fidel Castro, by dressing people up in Cuban uniforms and then killing them, and dressing them up in Cuban uniforms and then and saying they were invading Guantanamo, or sinking some of our ships, or blowing up our airplanes. And these were all various techniques they were going to use that were going to kill a lot of people, but it was going to get us into a war. And if you haven't read Operation Northwood, you need to. It was formerly top secret, and then, of course, it was eventually declassified. Fortunately, John Kennedy, or President Kennedy, refused to go along with that. A fascinating note in history of how people can be so dishonest, and even Americans can, when they think that what they're doing is justified because we had to get into a war with Fidel Castro. That was the way the Joint Chiefs of Staff felt, and that today there are people who feel that we have to go to war with Syria.
I'm going to disagree here, Dr. Stan. As you know, I believe that our government has been involved in using agent provocateurs to provoke war, such as Spanish-American War and even World War II with Pearl Harbor. The evidence is very strong. I sincerely believe, though, that Operation Northwood was a piece of disinformation that was written. In the first place, here's a couple of things the way I analyze it. They first of all targeted the Joint Chiefs, which have never frankly been known to originate any of these kinds of agent provocateur evidences. Military men, you know, have been yes men, it's true, but they don't conjure up these kinds of heinous acts. Globalists do. People who are insider, conniver, conspirators with government, they do these things. And President Kennedy, frankly, was you know, a yes man to the globalist. And this, I believe, was leaked to paint the American military in the days of Kennedy as these right-wing fanatics by leftist elements who produced this. I think that, frankly, it was a diversion from the true agent provocateur leaders within the globalist realm, and pinning something falsely on military leaders. Now, military leaders have gone along, as they did in Pearl Harbor. Some of the higher-ups, you know, Marshall, for example, who really went along with the globalist, became a globalist himself and perpetrated many things. Eisenhower did so as a yes man. But, you know, I'm just very suspicious of them pinning the whole Joint Chiefs. It just doesn't match any of my experience in the military that these yes men would be conjuring up this kind of thing that is typical of only dark conspirators who have a much greater political agenda that is not typical of our military leadership.
Well, that's a very interesting position. Okay, fine. Now, where do we go with it? What's going on over in Syria?
Let's see. I got sidetracked here.
I sidetracked you. You didn't get sidetracked.
Well, let me just say on the outset here that I'm no fan of Syria. They do intend to strike Israel and perhaps U.S. forces in Iraq someday. Syria is the haven of all Middle East terror organization groups in Damascus. Syria has the most modern, biggest stockpile of Scud missiles, although Egypt is a close second there. Syria is also developing chemical and biological weapons. But there is some evidence of cahoots with the British, too. The British have been very cozy with Syria in the past 3 or 4 years, much owing to the influence of Wafiq Saeed, their weapons. And he operates out of London with impunity under the nose of the British government. I can't believe the British government couldn't intervene and stop these weapons transfers to Syria if they wanted to. So there's more to this than we imagine, as you have indicated on your show many times, that illusion is king, and we need to talk about a little bit of reality. Pepe Escobar did come up with a very interesting anomaly, though, or similarity, talking about a not-so-far-fetched similarity of results between the puppet democracy of Lebanon, which has been controlled by Syria, and the puppet democracy that the U.S. is controlling in Iraq. Here's what his quote says. Sectarian tension will most likely be exacerbated both in Lebanon and in Iraq. We know that sectarianism is enshrined in Lebanon. The president has to be a Christian Maronite, the prime minister a Sunni, like Harari, and the speaker of the parliament has to be a Shiite. And he points out an inevitable parallel between the ongoing discussions, which I'm going to discuss in a minute there, in Iraq, where Shiites, Kurds, and Sunnis are trying to carve up the new Iraqi government. So with that, let me move on to the Iraqi election. A picture is beginning to emerge, allowing us, I think, to figure out how the U.S. is going to manipulate the results of this last week's election while still allowing the Shiites to fulfill their majority status. Is that a break I hear coming?
You hear that music. We'll just let that music go, and we'll be back in just a few moments with Joel Skelton. We'll tell you how, of course, it's that time to get a copy of the World Affairs Brief. And then, of course, after the half hour, we'll open up our lines to calls. But please hold your calls for the time being, at least until the half hour. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Joel Skousen, editor of World Affairs Brief. Pick up the story from there, Joel.
Well, talking about the Iraqi election. My title is Forced Compromise Built into the Structure. The Iraqi Shia Alliance won 140 seats out of the 275-seat National Assembly. This gives them an outright majority. In a normal parliamentary system, these results would allow the Shia Alliance to form a government without any further compromise with others, but not so in Iraq. The U.S. stipulated a key structural element before the elections that guaranteed compromise. That is, that they had to have a two-thirds requirement of unity to form a government. Now, this is unheard of in parliamentary politics where you only need a majority. This requires that the Shias will have to cut deals with the Kurds, who won 75 seats, and the Alawi regime, which won 40 seats, plus Sunnis, who ran won 2%. So there's a great deal. They're going to have to join coalition forces. They could do so with the Kurds alone, but the Kurds, have their own agenda. The U.S. has given them, by the way, a complete veto power over any item in the Constitution. That's another one of the little fine print things that the U.S. demanded. This proves that this wasn't a true democratic outcome. This was structured by the U.S. to control the outcome from the very beginning. Ahmad Jalabi, a secular Shia, who fronted for the CIA during the war and before, suddenly back with his hat in the ring, pushing to have his candidacy considered for a cabinet slot. Interim Prime Minister Ayad Alawi hopes that a deadlock in the negotiations will leave him in the Prime Minister slot, though I think he's got too many enemies for that. A bet is Abdelaziz Al-Hakim, the Shiite alliance leader. Al-Hakim lost 19 members of his family in the Saddam Hussein's purges. But other contenders for the top post include the aforementioned Ibrahim Yafari, senior official in the Shia Alliance, but also an interesting guy called Finance Minister Abdul Mahdi. Mahdi, representing the Siri Party, who used to join forces with Iran in fighting Saddam Hussein during the Iran-Iraq War, is a dark horse favorite of the Americans. He's made compromise and harmony his theme. That's what the Americans want to hear. He's talked about bringing in the Sunnis into the government, which is a violation of their refusal to participate in the election. But he made an appearance in December with Undersecretary of State Alan Larson at the National Press Club in Washington. And he said, to the delight of corporate U.S. oil interests, that, quote, a new oil law would privatize Iraq's oil industry. Well, no wonder Mahdi is being touted by U.S. corporate media as the next best candidate for prime minister. Asia Times asks, is it possible that Washington has made a deal, oil for power, with the Siri? I don't think so, frankly, Dr. Stan. It may be the other way around. The Shiites may think they are leading the Americans on with the lure of privatization in order to gain more freedom of movement than they would nationalize the oil after a few years when they gain their liberty. If so, I think they're dealing in wishful thinking on their part. The U.S. is ruthless about control, and I don't see any indication that they're going to give up control.
In other words, you think we intend to stay there despite all the things that we're being told about our men coming home just as soon as, it's stable, but I don't think it's ever going to be stable.
It will never be stable, not only because of the Iraq insurgency with almost unlimited arms and input of manpower, but also because of the looming confrontation with Iran and Syria.
I was going to say that the Joel has been saying that he feels that the election will lead to an unstable situation in Iraq, and that basically that the Americans really don't want a stable situation because we want an excuse to stay there more or less permanently. Would that be a fair statement, Joel?
Yes, there are real secret talks involving the Americans in their backdoor deal-making to create a new coalition government, and on efforts to lure the Sunnis into the fold and away from this so-called insurgency. But you know, Grand Ayatollah al-Sistani has been also stressing equal rights for all in the past few days. Now, there is no such thing as equal rights for all under Sharia law, which the Shiites claim will be the new basis for the Constitution, Islamic law. I suspect that al-Sistani has made his deal with the Americans in order to buy time. As Asia Times also observed, quote, most Shiite scholars insist the Americans must stay away from the writing of the new Constitution. But whether the Americans like it or not, Sharia law will prevail over civil law. What's left is a matter of degree. How deep will Sharia in Iraq rule over everything, apart from stating that women may not shake hands with men, music is allowed only if it's not for enjoyment, and daughters inherit less than their sons, unquote. That's an interesting view about equal rights compared to Sharia law. But it is expected that al-Sistani will have the last word as far as who will be the new Iraqi prime minister, being that that's going to be Shiite. He's hoping to refuse the Kurds their veto power over the Constitution, which, you know, as I said before, has already been dictated by the administrative law ordered by the U.S. The U.S. has also mandated as part of that administrative law that U.S. auditors will have total command of the financial structure of Iraq for the next 5 years. So much for Iraqi sovereignty that the President Bush proclaimed in his State of the Union address. Baghdad sources to Asia Times claims that a key reason for Sistani to bless the Shiite-dominated alliance was that he was assured a premortal role in drafting the Constitution. Moreover, according to Asia Times, Sistani himself is infinitely more popular and respected than the two main Shiite parties, Theory and the Dawah Party. Both of these were involved, of course, in with Iranian agents during the Iran-Iraq War, and thus the Sunnis, to them, they're anathema to them. So both the Shiites in the south and the Kurds in the north really are going to push for a federal form of government. I think this is how the Shiites want to pull off working their mutual goals with the Kurds. They want to push for autonomous regions in the north and the south. The U.S. doesn't want this. It's very disconcerting for U.S. plans to do that. And Asia Times has uncovered some very startling information about some covert operations that the U.S. is engaging in to head off this movement and to destabilize the Shiite alliance. Basically, what they've been doing is arming small militias backed by U.S. troops and entrenched in the population, so-called, to create inter-rival conflict there. And this may, I'll tell some other evidence about that in a minute, but Asia Times Online has learned that a highly clandestine operation is in effect where the U.S. is procuring Pakistani-manufactured weapons, including rifles, rocket-propelled grenades, ammunition, rockets, and other light weaponry. A lot of this is being flown into Iraq by U.S. military cargo aircraft at Chaklala Air Base. The aircraft arrived and departed for Iraq from Pakistan. So this is very serious. There's another interesting piece of information that was uncovered by Pepe Escobar. He's the Baghdad correspondent for Asia Times, and he did find out in talking to some of the insurgencies that they're scratching their heads on who's creating a lot of these car bombs. They don't seem to have been created by the insurgents, and they're wondering who's out there helping us. They're wondering if it's helping because they're targeting Iraqis that are not involved with Americans, which seems to be to provoke conflict among the Iraqis themselves.
In other words, there seems to be another force there that's doing a lot of the car bombings. The question is, if it's not the Sunnis, if it's not the insurgents, who would benefit from creating chaos and continued chaos there in Iraq? We'll be back in just a moment with our special guest for the evening, Joel Skousen of World Affairs Brief. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest, because Joel Skousen. Joel, go ahead and pick the story up. And, of course, Joel is raising the question, or at least saying that many of the Iraqi insurgents are wondering who is doing some of this car bombing. They're not doing it, and their people aren't doing it. So there seems to be another force over there that's maintaining this chaotic situation. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes. You know, the insurgents are clearly targeting what they call collaborators with the American occupation, and that a lot of these car bombings have not been against collaborators, and you know, especially the Beirut one does really smack of black operations because of the power of the blast, the sophisticated level of some of these explosives used there.
If they're suicide bombers, we can probably assume that they're not intelligence operations, but rather they are fanatics. But if they're not suicide bombings, then do we think that might be a good way to differentiate
them?
Well,
yes, but you've got to look closely at the type of explosives used in the sophistication of the operation. If you're just going to target Rafik Hariri, then certainly a sniper would have done, or any number of covert ops. If Syria wanted to do it, they could have poisoned him while he was in Syria, you know, just last week. So, you know, it's very unlikely that Bashar Assad would have brought upon himself. He's been bending over backwards trying to avert giving the U.S. any excuse to strike his nation and, you know, to pull something off like this that would be so obviously pointed at Syria as the main provocateur would just be stupid and extreme on his part. So I'm very, very skeptical that this was a Syrian operation. It's like the Chechen takeover of the school in southern Russia. I mean, here you had Russians doing the dirty work, calling themselves Chechens, working with international communications on this thing, and then killing, you know, 700 hostages. This is not something you do if you're trying to make your movement for Chechen liberty more popular around the world. And it's the same thing with Bashar Assad. He's not stupid. I don't think he's going to pull off a kind of assassination with a car bombing that kills dozens and wounds over 100 people. He's just not smart.
Yes, I'll never forget when that Chechen attack on the school, and some of these Chechens didn't even speak Chechen. They spoke Russian, so you had to sort of wonder who they really were.
That's right. Moving on to another subject, the president has appointed John Negroponte, National Intelligence Director of National Intelligence, the new DNI post. Former ambassador to the UN, former ambassador, or just recently ambassador to Iraq, in charge of this huge embassy that the United States has built there.
Hold that thought there for just a minute, Joel, as we bring our other stations on. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Joel Skousen, and we're going to be discussing the new man who's going to take over the intelligence or the home security. Anyway, one of the two. But before we get to that, let's, of course, let Joel tell you how you can get his information, how you can subscribe to his regular newsletter. Go ahead, Joel.
My newsletter is the World Affairs Brief, a weekly news analysis service of the type we're talking about here in the news. I try to put together a lot of pieces from many different sources. Almost everything I use is open source material. But it's my analysis, my view of what I believe the ulterior motives are of governments that explain what's really going on in the news. You can see much of my work on my website, worldaffairsbrief.com, including the daily postings from my two excellent researchers who just scour the internet every day and post the best stories up, and they're free of charge. Anyone can go look at the news, and I encourage you to do so. My analysis at the end of each week of those news stories, putting all the pictures together, is by subscription, a very modest fee of $36 a year. And you can subscribe right online. If you don't have access to the web, you can get a free print edition of the latest World Affairs Brief by calling toll-free 877-518-5888. That's 877-518-5888.
Now that's 877-518-5888. Okay, fine, and I will tell you that it's excellent material, and certainly if you have access to the web, you should go there every morning to worldaffairsbrief.com, pull down the information. You won't have to spend hours going over the entire web. Most of the important things are there, and you can pull them down, watch them, read them, copy those that you want to, and you'll be on top of everything of any real importance that happened literally anywhere in the world the previous day. So go ahead, Joe.
Well, John Negroponte has had a real checkered service. I had to kind of laugh at the statement of our illustrious Senator Dianne Feinstein of your state of California, who said, "I also believe that it is helpful that Mr. Negroponte comes to his position from outside of the intelligence community. It is fair to say that there are significant turf issues, significant technical issues, and I believe that Ambassador Negroponte brings the particular talents to bear." Now, this is just hogwash. Ambassador Negroponte was and has worked for the CIA most of his career in the Foreign Service. Almost every one of the high-level postings to embassies are CIA employed, so he does not come from outside the intelligence community. In fact, he's very much an insider in terms of dark side operations, just like Porter Goss in the CIA. When he was in Honduras, for example, he was implicated in some of the what they call the ongoing death squads down there. Now, frankly, I'm not as anti-death squad as most of the left points out, and the reason I say that is because what the news never tells you is the ones they were targeting were communists down in those countries. When you had a judiciary in Latin American countries that was made up of communists on the bench who would never prosecute any of those brought before them, a nation really had very little choice but to go underground with their prosecution, and that's what these so-called death squads were doing. It wasn't indiscriminate. It was targeting communists in their support networks. It would be better, of course, if governments, had a decent judiciary where they could prosecute people without going to official vigilantism. But that's the untold story of death squads, is that the press is actually covering, by denigrating them, covering for their attacks on communists. And, of course, they've been after all of those military governments who have used death squads to rid their countries of terrorists and communists. President Pinochet in Italy, the military in Uruguay and Argentina, Brazil, all those countries had to resort to death squads because the leftist judiciary would not prosecute the communists and the terrorists. Now, where was I when I got to that? But
you
anyway,
were
talking John
Negroponte, and you said that he was had been part of our intelligence network, and of course he had been associated when he was in Honduras with the people who were running the death squad. So they pick it up from there.
Yes, it was Battalion 316 kidnapped, tortured, and killed hundreds of civilians. Of course, I'm reading from the traditional press. They don't say they were communist and fellow travelers of communists, and part of the terrorist movement in those times. Of course, this was part of the Iran-Contra thing, which was also using trading arms to terrorists involved in support, supposedly, to overthrow the Sandinistas, which the government of the United States helped bring the Sandinistas to power by toppling pro-Western Anastasio Somoza.
And then, of course, they found created the Contras to topple the people that put in power, and most Americans have no idea that you play both sides against the middle, and of course,
right,
an awful lot of people get killed.
And then, of course, a lot of that was to control the drug trade, which the CIA was using to finance most of its black operations. That's involved with Barry Seal in Mena, Arkansas, and Fort, there's a couple of places in Arizona which are import points in this drug pipeline from the CIA. But in any case, what I wanted to point out is that this is no independent as a national intelligence director, or anyone who got the slot to take over the Iraqi embassy was a real inside player. And essentially, the Bush administration is really locking down the shops, so to speak, and make sure that There's going to be no whistleblowers coming out of these systems. Interestingly enough, his deputy now will be Lieutenant General Michael Hayden. Career Air Force Intelligence Officer General Hayden is now in charge of the National Security Agency, America's largest intelligence service, and chief of the Central Security Service. In my opinion, he, in fact, is going to be running the National Director of Intelligence. I think Negroponte is essentially there for damage control and to interface with the globalist insiders within the White House. He's going to be the one supposedly briefing or among the briefers for the president, but I still think that's more window dressing. I think Hayden is the real man to watch here.
Okay, that sounds well. We'll just keep an eye on General Hayden then.
Going back to the Middle East, Israel's parliament finally gave approval Wednesday to Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's plan to unilaterally disengage from the Gaza Strip, to abandon all of the 20-some settlements in Gaza, give them over to the Palestinian terrorists, and abandon also four West Bank settlements. And this is only the beginning. It has been leaked out from his government. He intends to abandon all settlements outside the Green Line, that imaginary line of demarcation from the original wars. Brings Israel down to a very small nation, indefensible in my opinion, in the next Middle East war. What was significant about the vote, it was 59-40, not that close. This was a bill to authorize the actual eradication of the settlers, compensating them with some $871 million. This is a nearly bankrupt government. Where they're going to get $871 million to do this bailout, I don't know. But in any case, what was telling is that some 17 of the 40 members of Sharon's own Likud party broke ranks and voted against the bill, as well as, of course, most of the right-wing parties who had left the Sharon government before. He joined forces once again with Labor, the left-wing government, to form a new coalition government.
Well, you know, it's so amazing to me that Sharon could be elected saying one thing and then turn around and doing exactly the opposite, and the people who voted for him don't even remember what he promised when he came into power.
You know, I have Jewish friend of mine who lives in America taking me to task. First of all, he complimented me. He's a subscriber to my World Affairs Brief and says, you know, you do an excellent job on Israel, and you really tell it as it is about the blankety blank blank. He just was cursing the name of Ariel Sharon, how much he betrayed, and he just lies, and he has crossed all his red lines that he said he would never cross. And I said, but you really are harsh about President Bush, Joel. And I said, you know, what you don't understand is that, you know, what you can see so clearly in Ariel Sharon, the Israelis themselves can't see in this border, and you as an American can't see it in Bush when it's the exact same thing.
I remember.
He does one thing and does another, and he betrays our very interests.
I remember when George Bush was talking about that terrible Bill Clinton and how he got us involved in Bosnia and in Kosovo and all these things. We never should have been. That is not the function of the United States to be nation building. That was the words that George W. Bush used before he became president, and now what's he doing? Why they call it nation building.
Yes. An interesting story coming out of Israel Insider. That's one of the few main line of publications in Israel that has had the courage to publish Barry Chamish's material. They're getting raked over the coals by the likes of Daniel Pipes and other neocons who pretend to be pro-Israel but in fact are globalists, playing both sides of the fence. Daniel Pipes, as you remember, wrote the book Conspiracy. He's a major debunker about conspiracy and clearly part of the other side. But in any case, they're attacking Israelinsider.com. It's a great publication. They just broke the story. It's a great story about the 350 Palestinian prisoners who have been released by Israel are being integrated into the Palestinian Authority security forces.
And these are terrorists. These are Palestinian terrorists who never should have been allowed out of Israeli prison.
That's right. This was part of an agreement reached by PA Chairman Mahmoud Abbas and leaders of the Palestinian militant factions. the militiamen who were on Israel's list of wanted terrorists, and arrested and then released, have belonged to various terrorist groups, including Hamas and Islamic Jihad. And now they're going to be trained partially by U.S. forces as part of Israeli security or Palestinian security services. And these are typical of the armed wing of the Fatah, the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade. These are in the security services, have been in the Oslo Accord. Abbas said, in his accepting of this proposal, the Palestinian Authority does not distinguish between the wanted men. They are entitled to join the security forces because of their involvement in the resistance. Isn't that interesting?
And so once again, why the American military will be training the terrorists. And
that's
this is
part of why we're giving
and over again. And arm the terrorists and finding one or another means to give money to the terrorists, and then we give money to the Israelis, and then we play but one side against the other.
That's right. Once again, in other news in Israel, the government comes to the defense of Ariel Sharon. They've dropped charges for Sharon in the funding scandal. They are continuing to prosecute his son, Omri. This was a three-year investigation into allegations that Sharon and his son set up shell companies to funnel foreign donations to Mr. Sharon's election campaign. And foreign political funding, of course, is illegal in Israel. Why you can absolve Sharon of any involvement here and prosecute his son, I have no idea why. But it's part of the immunity that these people are promised, when you collude with government. Big story in Nepal, of course, King Gyanendra has signaled a major shift in strategic direction for this impoverished Southeast Asian nation. Basically, the king dismissed the government of Prime Minister Bahadur late last month in favor of direct rule, has begun to orient the country's policies away from the West and towards China. He's already signaled a shift in his policy by closing down the Kathmandu offices of Tibet spiritual leader, the Dalai Lama. He's also begin. By the way, the Western forces have been pouring in a lot of military arms and ammunition into Nepal to fight a Maoist insurgency. Now, the Maoist insurgents are, of course, being armed by Red China itself, so this is very telling when the king dismisses the government that was put together specifically to attempt to put down this insurgency. Why they haven't, they have certainly been ineffective, to be sure. They've got hundreds of thousands, about 140,000 troops versus approximately 4,000 insurgents, and they haven't been able to wipe them out. But in any case, the king indicates he wants to go to a policy of negotiation with them, and it looks like he's doing that in the service of China.
And, of course, I think we're going to aggressively see China coming to dominate all of the countries in its neighborhood. And I really feel that before long, China certainly will be the dominant force by far in the Far East. In fact, perhaps one of the soon the dominant force in the world. At least this is their goal. Let's go to Jack, who's calling from Michigan. Jack, did you have a question for our guest?
Well, let's boycott all China-made products, eh?
Okay, do you have a question?
Yes. Joel, Junior Luciferian Bush said, subsequent to his inaugural speech originally, that this is the new crusade relative to the axis of evil. And as I understand it, the so-called war in Iraq was not an officially declared war by Congress, and somehow they delegated that fiduciary duty over to Junior Bush. And now he believes he's got a mandate from the American people since he was reelected by, he believes, they. So now, isn't it the case that the executive orders that have been issued is really how he's ruling dictatorially, irrespective of Congress's constitutionally mandated duty?
Let's get Joel's thoughts on that.
Certainly Congress has abdicated its responsibility to control this war, and one of the reasons they've been able to abdicate this responsibility is that they have not passed upon the funding of this war to the American people. They keep doing this by deficit financing, supplemental budgets. It wasn't even in this massive $2.5 trillion budget. I believe that if the American people were having to foot the bill for this war, it would become immediately unpopular, and people would demand that Congress pull back this authorization. It's really an illegal authorization, as you point out, to let the president run rampant with this war. You know, he is coming back to Congress with these funding alternatives, but, you know, the U.S. Continues to manipulate the press to the extent that it's a done deal. No one will vote against the war in Iraq.
And I think it's really so interesting that the president said we will have a lean budget, we're going to cut spending, and then he increased the spending, and nobody pointed out he's going the on-budget items are $89 billion more than last year, but of course most of the spending for the war and so many other things will be off-budget, aren't even included in the budget, and I hate to think what the deficit is going to be next year. We're going to be back in just a moment to wrap up the program. Our special guest this evening has been Joel Skousen of World Affairs Brief. Well, Joel, we've got 3 minutes. Would you like to wrap up the program for us this evening?
Okay, well, I can remember the time, Dr. Stan, when we were horrified that the budget finally went over a trillion. Do you remember that?
That's when, of course, Jimmy Carter was the president, and during his 4 years in office, he increased the budget $200 billion. Well, last year, what did we do, about $600 billion, you know, in 1 year?
Well, you know, the official estimate is $427 billion in deficits for this budget, but this doesn't include many things. It doesn't include the massive overrun of the prescription health care benefit, which estimates now are doubled. The original estimate of $400 billion for the next 10 years are going to be...
And we haven't even started the program, and it's already doubled in cost. That's really a nice story.
Isn't that amazing? It doesn't include the effects of the tax cut being made permanent. I'm for those tax cuts, even though I believe that the purpose of a tax cut is to restrict government spending. Now that government spends with abandon, regardless of whether they have the money, you know, they're relatively meaningless. Might as well not pay any taxes. The government's going to continue spending to oblivion, precisely because I believe, Dr. Stan, they know that a major world war is coming where the U.S. is going to be targeted and that they're never going to have to pay off the debt. Despite all talks of balancing the budget or cutting the deficit to zero in 5 years or 10 years, it never happens. The surplus never happened, you know, that was supposed to happen during the Clinton administration. That was simply inflationary pumping up of the money supply. But in any case, these budgets are hurting, for the short term at least, the dollar's ability to compete with the euro. I still don't believe the dollar is in danger of complete collapse, mainly because there aren't enough euros, nowhere near enough euros to replace the dollar as an international currency, and people who hold dollars right now, including most of your oil exporting nations like OPEC, certainly cannot afford to dump dollars lest they lose the value of the currency in their own bank accounts. So, but the Federal Reserve is definitely having to raise interest rates to give at least the appearance of some recognition that they have been overspending to try to bring down the current account deficit. I, you know, don't for a minute believe that they're going to be able to do so. If they really stopped increasing the money supply, they would have a major recession on their hands, if not a depression. And so they will continue to pump up the money supply. We will continue to have inflation. And believe me, there's a lot of money floating around still buying up homes, which are well overvalued, especially in California.
Okay, we're going to have to let you go here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this evening has been Joel Skousen. Joel, thanks just very much for being with us. It's always fascinating. We look forward to having you on with us again next week.
My pleasure.
Good night, and God bless you. Okay, fine. That was Joel Skousen. And, of course, this is the time when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. And if you are out there listening to us across America, we do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. I would remind you that we do carry have access to the Berkey products, and if you're interested in them and you get them through Radio Liberty, why, you get a video or an audio for tape set that we have actually produced. Remember our telephone number, it's 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we have a very, very special offer. We have actually been able to get the cost of our book, Brotherhood of Darkness, down to a phenomenal level if we can print enough of them. And so we're making an offer to our listeners who are willing to take an entire case of Brotherhood of Darkness, that's 62 books. But it's really sort of unbelievable. If you'd like to know more about it, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to get a case of Brotherhood of Darkness and get them out, because I think it is an excellent tool to begin to educate people about the spiritual nature of the battle in which we're engaged. If we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield, but unless you understand that there is another dimension, there really are people who sold their souls to the devil, who worship evil. When you understand that, you can understand anything going on today. And if you don't understand that, nothing really makes sense. So remember, if you'd like to get the case of the Brotherhood of Darkness, call us at 1-800-544-8927. If you've not yet heard the 3 or the 4 or the 10-hour version of They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll, you need to think about getting one for your children and for your grandchildren, because they have to understand the true nature of the struggle. And then, of course, the videos, Megiddo 1, which, of course, goes into prophecy. Many people use it for teaching prophecy, but it takes you from the prophecies of Daniel in the Old Testament right up to the current wars and to World War III. A very effective, professionally done teaching tool, 2.25 hours. And then, of course, Megiddo 2 takes you from the Garden of Eden all the way up to, well, what's going on today. I'm in that one, along with Dave Hunt and of course, Kent Hovind, and a number of very, very good people. But we talk about the Georgia Guidestones. I talk about Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, and you'll actually see the Georgia Guidestones, so you don't have to go all the way back to Elberton to see this satanic monument, the American Stonehenge, the Georgia Guidestones, with the Ten Commandments that come from the pit of hell. So that's Megiddo 2, and so these are excellent teaching tools, and we certainly recommend them to you. And again, the number to call, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927, if you'd like more information. If you'd like to get a free copy of our newsletter, our November newsletter, it gives you the background of fluoride, water fluoridation. And of course, most people don't know when they put the fluoride in the water, what they're really doing is putting an industrial waste, and you get your lead, your arsenic, or cadmium, your polonium-20 along with your fluoride, and they're all toxic. And there's not one single study that's ever shown that this is safe. But then, of course, they don't tell you that. They tell you it's all about the children. Oh, we're so concerned about the children. They don't tell you that all the studies, massive studies, have shown there is no statistical difference between the areas that are fluoridated and non-fluoridated. And when Dr. William Hersey, who worked for the EPA and the Division of Drinking Water, testified before the Senate back in the year 2000, the controlled media totally blacked out his speech. But if you'd like, of course, to get that speech, that is a December newsletter. So you can either get the November or the December newsletter. Go to our website of RadioLiberty.com, and of course, you can get both newsletters. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you.